Can start. Boker Tov, everybody. Continuing in Pirkei Avot. Nice to see everybody. Hope everybody is doing well. Okay, we got up to Mishnah Yud. For those who have Pirkei Avot, if you don't, I'll say it, of course. Talked last week. We ended up talking about the importance of the court system and how to interrogate witnesses. What I did not say is basically we have two different types of interrogation we do by the court. But basically, the one was the basic information, who did what when, you know, as we would say. And if a person doesn't know, you cannot convict if one of the two witnesses, even if they don't contradict each other. But then we have what's going as bidikot, to check things. Those are what we call, like, was he wearing a blue shirt or a white shirt, or was it under an oak tree or a pine tree that it happened? And there the Mishnah says that it's okay if you don't know. You don't have to know that. You have to know when it happened, who did it, but you don't have to know what shirt he was wearing. However, if one says a pine tree and one says an oak tree, then you throw out the case. I want to mention that because the Mishnah says they call him Ben Zakkai. This must mean Rav Yochanan Ben Zakkai before he became a leader. We know until people got smicha or until you were married, for example, Ben Zoma, you were always referred to as the son of your father. So he's called Ben Zakkai, the son of Zakkai, which of course in itself is an interesting name. Zakkai means to merit, one who merited people. Zakkai lezakot. So here he would try to merit all the defendants. The Mishnah says Ben Zakkai would keep asking questions on sort of superfluous issues that really had nothing to do with the case at hand. You know, what size shoe did the person have? And he would ask all these questions until he would finally trip them up. So finally, somebody with the two witnesses would each give an answer because they thought they knew something, and they would contradict each other. And that way, he would let the witnesses go free, or not the witnesses, let the defendant go free. And this is probably in keeping with the view of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva said, had he been on a court, no person would ever have gotten a death penalty. He would have, and the Mishnah says, how could he do that? Mar said he would always find a way to get somebody out. And of course, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel said, with an approach like Rabbi Akiva, you're going to increase murderers in the Jewish people. And this, of course, is the debate we have down to this day. Is capital punishment a deterrent or not? But anyway, last week we saw that Shimon ben Shetach, Yehuda ben Tabai, accidentally put somebody to death. He made a mistake on Edim Zomimim, on false witnesses, and he missed the technicality and he put somebody to death. And his whole life he was mourning. He went to the grave of the person he had killed. And Shimon ben Shetach also made a mistake. He killed 80 women in one day. Court is only allowed to put to death one person a day. And that's why they both talk about the importance of cross-examining witnesses. And when the litigants are in court, we must take a tough position. And when they leave, we have to be nice and friendly. But you have to assume people lie. We did. We have to dana kol adam lekav zchut. You have to judge everybody, like, you know, favorably. We spoke about it a couple weeks ago. That's only in our normal interactions. When you're in a court of law, you don't judge anybody favorably. The assumption is the person's lying. And the role of the judges is to find out what that lie might be. But then when the case is over, it's a whole different ballgame. Okay, so let's continue. Perek Aleph Mishnah Yud. Shmaya v'Avtalyon kiblu mehem. So Shmaya v'Avtalyon, they're already a little bit more famous. As we get closer to, you know, the time really of the beginning of the Mishnah, we're still not really in the Mishnah yet. I mean, they're quoted in the Mishnah, but this is really pre-Mishnaic literature. Shmaya v'Avtalyon are the fourth of the five sets of Zugot. It's very interesting. They are the teachers, as we'll see in a few minutes, of Hillel and Shammai. And according to the Rambam, Shmaya v'Avtalyon were converts. They were descendants of Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin had really a major role in Jewish history, both, of course, in a very negative sense, but somewhat, some, like you want to call it, a silver lining. Sanhedrin is the one in 721 BCE, was responsible for the exile of the 10 tribes, Assyrians, and the exile of the northern kingdom, and that was the loss of the 10 tribes. But what he also did, which we know happens in the modern world too, he mixed up all the nations, as the Gemara says, Bilbela Kolamot, you know, ethnic cleansing. That's a very negative terminology today, if you do ethnic cleansing. But that's really what he did. And maybe he did the opposite. He mixed up all the nations, so we don't know who anybody is. So that it's based on that that you're allowed to accept an Ammonit or Moavit. I think we spoke a few weeks ago on the day when Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah became, I think in our first class, we spoke about the debate between Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Should Jewish education be, or let's say higher Jewish education be for everybody, the elite of the elite to produce excellent people? Or, only for the elite. That was Rabban Gamliel's opinion. Or do you have Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's opinions for everybody? And that they, when he was appointed, he opened up the Beit Midrash. And then the Talmud says on the first day, the day he was appointed, a convert came and he wanted an Ammonite convert, a descendant of Ammon or Moab came and he wanted to convert. And Rabbi Gamliel said, of course he can't convert. There's a verse in the Torah that an Ammonite or Moabite cannot convert. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, what are you talking about? Rabbi Yeshua said, what are you talking about? Sanhedrin came and he mixed up all the nations. We don't know who anybody is. We don't know the lineage of everybody. And therefore, we can assume they're not. So that sort of was a more quote unquote liberal approach. And therefore they let them in. The Rambam claims, people claim that Shmaya and Naftalion were descendants of Sanhedrin, the one who created this whole mess. He exiled the 10 tribes, but he sort of, we don't know who an Amalekid is. We don't know who Ammon is. We don't know Mitrim. We don't really know who anybody is, where they come from. So his grandchildren, great-grandchildren are Shmaya and Naftalion. We have the same idea that Haman's, children, there's a medrash that the descendants of Haman learned Torah, I think it's by Haman, learned Torah in Bnei Brak. So the rabbis really, I think, are teaching us is that the greater the power for evil, the greater the power for good. Just like in physics, Newton's third law of motion, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So too in the spiritual world, if you're not gonna, you don't have the potential to be evil, you don't have the potential to be great. Greatness and evil, and sometimes we know there's a fine line between greatness and evil at times. So people who are evil often have great talent. They just misuse it. And then if we apply that talent, we have the opposite or the most wonderful extreme, which is of course the basis of the statement that a bal tshuva, a repentant, some who returns is on a higher level than a person who did not sin, because that power for evil is much greater. That's a Rav Aaron Soloveitchik once gave a whole talk about them. Was in Yeshiva University, how the power for evil is much, much greater. He explained that's how Shlomo HaMelech knew which mother was right on the kids. It's not because the real mother wouldn't let the kid be chopped in half. It's because the fake mother, the false mother, would let the kid be chased in half. That was an insight Rav Aaron Soloveitchik quoted by Freud, that the power for hatred is greater. So the willingness to kill is much more. So Shlomo Melech knew by the one who was willing to let the kid be chopped in half, that wasn't the mother. It's quite a sad insight, but I think it's true. And therefore, if we can take that power, the Baal Tshuva takes that power so he can be much greater. And we see that all the time. Someone who changes their life from something they're not doing well usually has much more energy and much more drive to do what's good. So when the rabbis make comments like the descendants of Sanhedrin were great rabbis and they're Haman's descendants, it doesn't have to be interpreted in a literal way, although I guess it could be. But I think it's the idea of the transferring from hatred, from negative to good. Anyway, but the view of the Rambam, the Tosfot Yontif here on the Mishnah, he doesn't like it at all. Lots of people don't like this view of the Rambam, and this gets into a very modern issue, a little bit of a sensitive issue. Those who were on the shir last night, but Rabbi Avineri spoke on slavery, and it's sort of a sensitive issue for modern people. But many people say, what do you mean? It's impossible that Sanhedrin, they were converts. Why is it impossible that they were converts? Because you're not allowed to appoint the convert to a position of authority in the Jewish community. You cannot make a convert the abbeitin or the nasi, perhaps. That's a major question we have today. That's the same question. I know I'm opening up many cans of worms, but it's many ways the same question about a woman being a rabbi. The idea that the people of authority have to it all stems from the idea that you can only have a melech, you can only have a king. The queen is married to the king, but you can't have Queen Elizabeth, who runs, for those who, you know, in Canada, can't have a queen as the head of the state, melech velo malka. And the Rambam famously extends that to all positions of communal authority. Not everybody agrees with the Rambam. And then the question is, how do you define authority? And is a rabbi today have authority? And there are communities, I think there are movements that will not accept, maybe it sounds really not so pleasant, a convert to be a rabbi, but there are others. There are, I'm not here to give a shear whether a ger can become chief rabbi, but here in the Mishnah, that's what some of the commentators say. It's impossible that they were converts, because Shmaiva Abtalion, because they couldn't have been the Abbeitin. Now, what's fascinating, it's the Rambam. It's the Rambam who says, the same Rambam who extends the prohibition to women, he doesn't talk about converts there, extends the prohibition, is the one who says that they were actually converts. Whatever the case, that's just an interesting historical background, exactly who Shmaiva Abtalion were. And the reason this comes up is because they couldn't pronounce Hebrew 100%. That's part of the whole equation here. The Mishnah in Etuyot quotes Hillel, quoting his teacher Abtalion, and he quotes him in a very strange language. He, Maim, Shubim has to do with the mikvah, the terminology. And the Mishnah points out, you know, this is a weird way of speaking, but Chayav Adam, a person is obligated to quote his teacher exactly. That's a fascinating statement. A person should quote his teacher exactly. So he said it over the way his teacher said it over. And the commentaries explain, it had to do with the letter hey. So obviously their pronunciation is different. You know, we don't pronounce Hebrew the way the Yemenites or the real people who know Hebrew, the guttural sounds and all of this stuff. So apparently, we all know, non-Jews can't pronounce, Chanukah. They weren't brought up that way. So apparently that was the issue, that Shmaiva Abtalion couldn't pronounce some of the things. So they said it in sort of, other language, and then Hillel copied that language. And why did he copy that? Because they didn't know. They weren't brought up saying Hebrew. It's sort of a very fascinating idea. This idea of quoting, you should always quote your teacher exactly. I will say a fascinating comment of Rav Kook on this. The Gemara says that Rav Elazar HaGadol, Rav Elazar HaGadol was he never said anything his teacher didn't teach him. You would ask him a question, and if he wouldn't answer you. If he didn't hear it from his teacher, he wouldn't say, he would not answer. He only said over things. He was the most unoriginal person in the world. He only said over things he heard from his teacher. That's the Gemara in Sukkah. Then the Gemara says there was nobody. If you heard Rav Elazar give a speech, you was like listening to Torah from Har Sinai. It was so original and so unbelievable. Wow, people were like blown away. They've never heard something so original. So these Gemaras obviously contradict each other. Was he somebody who was a great original thinker, or was he somebody who was only quoted what his teacher says? And Rav Kook has a beautiful explanation. It's not a contradiction. You can say exactly what your teacher says it, but you put it in language that's understandable. It doesn't mean you have to quote the same phrase. It means you have to explain over, but you can say the same thing in many ways. And the greatness of Rav Elazar is he took ideas and then he applied them using the same terminology, the same ideas, but it was like so brilliant and so new. And I think anybody who's familiar with the workings of Rav Soloveitchik I don't know that Rav Soloveitchik ever quotes this in his writings, but I think that this is a perfect description of Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik saw himself as, saying he only does what his grandfather does. Okay, somebody's telling me when I look directly into the camera light, it's annoying. It interferes with the view. Okay, so hold on. Let me turn off the light in the room, if that helps. Thank you for that comment. Is this any better? No better. Okay. Maybe it's the outside. Is this better? This is better. Okay. I'm sorry. All right. I'm sorry about that, but thank you for the comment. Okay. Please let me know if I'm annoying you or whatever and you can't see. Okay. Zev, I can't hear you, but okay. Well, fine. Now let me turn on the light so I can see my notes. Hold on. Okay, you can see me still. So anyway, so Rabbi Soloveitchik saw himself as totally faithful to the tradition of Brisk, and he never deviated. But believe me, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik didn't know the first thing about philosophy and Neo-Kantian philosophy, which is where Rabbi Soloveitchik got his PhD. If you read the beginning of Halachic Man, what Rabbi Soloveitchik did is he took terminology from the yeshiva and philosophy, and he merged them into one. So Rabbi Soloveitchik was a staunch traditionalist, at the same time so modern and so innovative, both at the same time. That was Rabbi Eliezer. So one can be one can repeat things exactly from his teacher, and yet at the same time be totally original. That's that takes a great person, and it's basically applying ancient the Torah to modern life. And that's really what I think, that's really in one sentence can almost summarize the brilliance and the greatness of Rav Soloveitchik, which manifests itself in so many ways. Anyway, let's get back to what they said, not back. Let's begin what they actually said, Shmaya of Talion. So Shmaya says, Ahov et ha-melacha. You have to love work. Usnat ha-rabbanut. Hate being a rabbi, hate rabbanut here doesn't only mean a rabbi, it probably also means a rabbi, although they didn't have professional rabbis back then. Hate lordship, hate ruling over others, but al titva dal rashut, and don't get too close to rashut, those who give permission, that's of course to politicians. They'll throw you under the bus in 1 second. So the first thing he says is you have to love work. You have to love to work. And the Bartanura points out this has nothing to do with how wealthy you are. You're not working because you have to earn a living. Of course, one has to do that. That's the basic obligation. It's written in the Ksuva. When you get married, it says that the husband's going to support his wife. That's the basic obligation of a husband. And of course, but what the Mishnah here is saying is you have to love the concept of work. Yafet Talmud Torah in Derech Eretz is a similar idea. Even if you are a multimillionaire, to sit around and to do nothing is an awful life. And the Mishnah doesn't say sit and learn Torah all day. That's not what it says. He says you have to love to work. And the Barnum says everybody should go to work. Everybody should make a contribution to the physical world, do something. And it's probably true that milacha, ehov et ha-milacha, it doesn't say ahov et ha'avodah, all right? And we know that in halachic literature, there's a difference between avodah and milacha. Avodah means work. We were slaves to Paro, avodat perach, right? This week's parsha, you're not allowed to make a Jew work avodat perach. You're not allowed to make your worker work meaningless work, right? Busy work, just to keep them busy. That is no, and reason that's a prohibition in the Torah, that's turning him into a slave. That's exactly the parameters is for another time. Milacha, we all know, is creative work. That's the 39 forbidden activities on Shabbat. So when Shmaya says, Ehov et ha-milacha, if you want to be precise in his terminology, which I think in the Mishnah we can and should be, so it means be creative, like doing things that make a contribution to the world. What is milacha? Those acts that benefit the world. Just avodah, doesn't work. And of course, milacha was mainly in the world of, it's clothing and it's baking, clothing, hunting, right? All the milachot, the first 11 milachot have to do with baking bread, and then has to, how do you get your clothes? You hunt and you shear, etc., building. So all the creative activities. So somebody should make a contribution, even if you're, no matter how wealthy you are. So because there's an inherent value in milacha. The Tiferet Yisrael, the Tosfot Yontif has a beautiful, very interesting point. It says, you know why you have to love work? Because if you love work, you'll do it better. Because things you like to do, you do better. And if you do it better, you'll make more money. You'll be better at what you do. That's what he says. You have to love work, so you'll do better at work. When somebody does a job because they have to do a job, they don't do it as well as if they want to do a job. So somebody should want to work. He actually quotes, that's Yaakov Avinu. Torah doesn't exactly say this, but it says Yaakov Avinu, when he worked for Rachel for 7 years, it was very fast because it was like very few years. I would think it's the opposite because he was waiting for Rachel. The 7 years were longer, but it says, no, he loved her so much that it passed by really quickly, the 7 years he had to work. And the idea was apparently what the Tosfot Yonim saying he loved his work so much, he loved it, he got, you know, you don't notice when you're involved. Why did he love his work? Because his work was a mechanism to get the wife that he wanted. So he put his full heart and soul into it, which we know the rabbis do point that out about Yaakov, and therefore he loved it, he did it better, and time passes. He quotes that, it's very interesting, Tosfot Yonim, and in the same comment, he quotes that very often people who work in, out in the on the docks, they would sing while they worked. They would sing. Why would they sing? Because when you sing, you're happy. That's we all know that. It's very hard to sing and be sad. I mean, maybe you're sad too. But even there, generally, when we sing, you know, we're in a good mood. Nusach is so important for that reason. Singing in shul, singing in the Beit HaMikdash. So people would sing, so they would like their work better. No. And it's very interesting. But Ehoved HaMelachat Sna Et HaRabbanut. So the link the Bartanur makes, the most commonly love work or love creativity, and hate lordship. So he says, he quotes the famous Gemara, a person shouldn't say, work, you know, that's very nice, that's not for me. I'm too great a person, I'm a Torah scholar, I can't do work. And the Gemara says, flay carcasses in the marketplace rather than ask people for charity. It's a famous Gemara that even a person, the Rosh Yeshiva, if need be, the Rosh Yeshiva, if he doesn't have a way to make a living, he has to go to the marketplace in public, flee the carcasses. That was a very degrading form of work, because to make a living in any way is much more less degrading than taking of charity. Sometimes modern people have lost that idea, that to take money from someone was considered very negative. The Gemara talks about taking, so you should do anything to avoid taking charity from people. Sometimes today, especially, it's very hard. Where do you draw the line? That's also an important discussion. But conceptually, you should love work and hate, don't say that work is beneath me. That's if you want to combine the two ideas. The other idea, of course, the Mefarshim point out, and the Bartanur also points this out, is by lordship will to rule over other people is never a good idea. Our sages teach Yosef died first. You know, it says in Parshat Shmot, when it lists the 12 brothers, it says Vayamat Yosef b'chol achav. Right? I believe that's how the pasuk goes. Yosef and all his brothers died. So the rabbis understood. Yosef died first, and then his brothers. That's not so good. Yosef is the 11th brother. So and none of his 10 brothers died before he did. He died younger. We know he has the only age listed of the brothers who died. I think Levi might have 137 or 133, but Yosef died at 110. And the rabbis say, you know why he died young? Because he lorded over his brothers. He got smote b'rabbanut. You know, the way he treated his brothers, I'm the big shot here, and when you're the big shot and you rule over other people, it buries you. I think it means really anybody who works in public life, they age. If you do a good job in public, it does age you, and all the concerns, and there is something like that. Somebody has to do it. In other words, in that sense, it's a occupational hazard to become a leader is, if you take your job seriously and you deal with so many problems and pressures and et cetera, like we'll get to, it's not come up, but I can say it now, you know, what's the job of the rabbi? I've often quoted, I don't know if I quoted any of these classes, the rabbi, Rav Chaim Brisker, the great, you know, genius who invented the whole Talmudic method that we use. But somebody says I should close the blind before me. That's a little bit difficult because this room doesn't have any blinds. It goes to our backyard. So I apologize. Please, God, next week. I know I have my computer. I'm on a different computer than was last week, and I can't positioning. So I do apologize. Hold on. I'm going to do one more thing that may make it better. Is this any better? Is better? Better. Okay. You should have told me earlier. Okay. The chair's less comfortable, but okay. That's my problem. So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the great innovator of the Talmudic method, was a community rabbi in Brisk. I'm sure many of you have heard this. He has a famous idea. He was interviewed Some journalists interviewed him and the Aruch HaShulchan, and a few people asked him, what's the job of a rabbi? So the Aruch HaShulchan, Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein, great author of the Aruch HaShulchan, sort of a modern-day version of the Shulchan Aruch, said the job of a rabbi is to sit and learn and to paskin shaylos. Well, what else is a rabbi going to do? And of course, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik famously said the job of a rabbi is to take care of the widow, orphan, and the poor. And the true matter is that's what the commentary says. So it's Avtalion. Remember, this Mishnah is introduced, Shmayan Avtalion is, and the commentary explained that, what's the name Avtalion? It's a strange name. It says Avtali means the father of the young. He took care of orphans. In Aramaic, he was the father of the orphans. That's the job of the leaders, are to take care of people. But you know what? You take care of the orphans and the widows and the agunas and the sad stories and the this and the that. It's very hard, very hard. So leadership, it's not a revenue. To lord over other people is something that can create tensions, problems, but sometimes you have to do it. But Eoved HaMelacha, Snot, Rabbanut, and of course you have to realize in the time of the Mishnah you couldn't get paid. Like it's also go Ehoved HaMelacha, you couldn't make money from being a community leader. You're not allowed to make any money for doing a mitzvah. You have to love work. I'll just quote this: don't get too close to those who give permission. Don't get too close to politicians, because obviously, so the Bartanura says, this is such a modern idea, don't be so close to them so you'll get appointed to a position of power. That's how all politicians work, right? The Israeli government is not being sworn in because this one wants the cabinet. It's amazing, 120 members and 36 cabinet ministers. It's like unbelievable. But okay, I don't want to talk politics, but I just did, I'm sorry. But because everybody wants power, everybody, I'll be your friend and buddy up to get a position. Said you should never do that. We know that in the 1900s, Shaul Stamper, in his book on the Eastern European Rabbinate and the community, one of the ways the status of the Rabbanut went down in the 19th century is you had people from wealthy families. They would buy their position as the rabbi. People often have this misconception that, most people who studied Torah were poor. In Eastern Europe, it was the exact opposite. Only the wealthy could study Torah. If you weren't wealthy, you couldn't go to yeshiva because people went to work at 14, 13, 14, 12. They became an apprentice. They went to work. The idea of last education was insane. The community couldn't afford anything. You know, a rabbi would negotiate in a salary. They can get three people to learn, with me. The communities couldn't afford it. So the only people who went to learn in yeshiva, 95% of them, I don't know the exact number, but a very high percent came from very wealthy families. And then, of course, the wealthy balabatim at a time would want to marry the good boys in yeshiva, their daughters, marry off their daughters. So there was, of course, a merging of the rabbinic elite and the financial elite. And that can be nice, but I don't have to tell you that can lead to problems. And one of the problems is people would, want it for kavod. They had a lot of money. So I'll become the rabbi in your community. You don't have to pay me. I'll pay you for me to become the rabbi. I'm sure if you went to your shul and said, I'll pay $100,000 to be the rabbi. So I think in today's shul that throw you out, Baruch Hashem. But you understand the concept. So that's what the Bartanura says in a certain sense. Don't get too close. Don't try to buy your position. So they'll appoint you to positions. And it's, that is an important issue. Of course, the basic issue is don't get too close to politicians because they can't be trusted. We all know that. It's the nature of it's also an occupational hazard. That's why the Torah is very insistent on separation of church and state. I know people, but that's 100%. The Kohanim, and we know what happened when the Kohanim became the political leaders. For the politicians to mix into religion and religion to mix into politics, it's a terrible thing, and it's corruption all over the place. So the Torah is very insistent. Shevet Levi are the religious leaders, and Shevet Yehuda are the political leaders, and never the twain shall meet. Of course, the expectation is that the political leaders are going to be of a religious nature, obviously, not that they're not observant Jews, but you cannot mix in politics and religion. And I think here I'll say, I think, you know, what happens in Israel is very unfortunate for Torah purposes. When Torah becomes a negotiation tool and it gets in the dirt of the politics, it makes Torah all dirty. Maybe it was needed in 1948, maybe, I don't know. But anyways, talking a little bit too much politics than I should, especially with maybe some people I don't even know. People who know me a little bit, they know where I'm coming from a little bit more, perhaps. But anyways, but that's really what the mission is. Don't trust politicians. Politicians is a very dirty business. I often quote Rav Soloveitchik. I don't know if he said it a half joke. I heard it from Rav Schachter. I didn't hear it directly from Rav Soloveitchik. But Rav Schachter often quoted Rav Soloveitchik as saying that politics is kulo sheker. Politics is kulo sheker. It means 100% lies. So they asked him, "No, if it's kulo sheker, why don't they call it sheker?" Then so he said, "Because if they called it sheker, it'd have a little bit of emet. Not even the name is true." Okay, that's a bad joke or whatever. It's not, but you have to understand in context. So that's the third thing that Shmaya says: "Al titvadal l'rashut." Be very careful. In other words, there seems to be what he's saying here: don't having power is very dangerous, and you have to use it properly. Snat harabanut, don't like to lord over other people, and don't get too close to people who are in power. Be a nice, simple Jew, a nice, simple, pious Jew. It's a lot easier. When you get into power, it's harder. Yes, you have to make difficult decisions, and we need leaders, but they have to be of the right character. Okay, let's move on. Mishnah Yud Aleph, which we alluded to a few weeks ago because the Bartanur mentioned it, Avtalion Omer, Chachamim Hizaru B'Divreichem. Smart people, be very careful what you say. Again, fear of leadership. Leaders have to be very, very careful what they talk. Shema Tachobu Chobat Galut, maybe you'll cause exile. And we spoke a few weeks ago, the Bartanur actually says this was the mistake of Antignus Isocho. Antignus Isocho, when he said, don't do mitzvot for reward, which is a very nice, very beautiful idea. But apparently he said it in a way that his students, Sadok and Baitus, misunderstood it. I mean, there is no reward. There's a big difference in saying I shouldn't do it for reward, and there is no reward, and they became heretics. So that's an unbelievable idea. And so the Bartanura by Antignus Isocho, he quotes this, is that this was the mistake, and it's because of this Mishnah that Antignus Isocho was not careful in how he said what he said. And he said something very nice, religious teaching. How much more so when rabbis speak on things that are much broader, you have to be extremely careful. People misunderstand everything you say. It's the nature of life. So you have to be careful because people are going to be exiled. Yishtua talmidim abimacharim v'yamutu. People will then take, they'll drink the forbidden waters from them, and they'll die. V'nimsa shem shemayim mitchalol. You'll cause a desecration of God's name. So that's, we know that, of course. It's not, and we're not talking here Lashon Hara, like the details of Lashon Hara. We're talking about how you present things, what you say, you know, one comment, everybody knows, you know, you can make a comment, an off-the-cuff comment sometimes, and in the wrong context, it can haunt you the rest of your life. We all know people whose career was destroyed because of one comment, one thing they did. Yesh koneh olamo b'sha'achad, one can acquire their entire world in one moment. The Gemara says, and one can lose their entire world in one moment. So you have to be very careful. It's interesting in the laws of oaths, Nidarim is in Parshat Matot, right? The end of Sefer Bamidbar. And when the Torah introduces the laws of oaths, it says, Vayedaber Moshe el Roshei HaMatot. Moshe spoke to the leaders of the Jewish people. This week we have the problem, why did Moshe speak at Har Sinai? Ramayan Shemitah L'Archel Har Sinai. What do I mean? He spoke to the leaders. He always spoke to the leaders. Rambam this way spoke to the leaders. They spoke to the people. So why here is it mentioned? So some of the commentaries point out, because when it's the leaders who you have to really like speak to about being careful of how you speak. So the Parsha in the Torah that talks about taking an oath, and that's said to the leaders. Of course, it applies to everybody, but they're the ones, because leaders often make promises. I don't have to tell you. That's what politicians do. They make promises and they don't keep them. So that's why Roshe Matot, be very, very careful. Amor ma'atva sehar bay. Say little and do more. Okay, let's move on to the next Mishnah. Let's get to Hillel and Shammai. Kiblu mehem. The last of the five zugot. Hillel and Shammai, of course, the most famous, perhaps, of all the Tanaim, this is the transition generation from the Zugot, the last generation of Zugot, and really the beginning of the Mishnah, the first generation of the Mishnah. And we've mentioned Hillel and Shammai. The Talmud says only have three arguments, which are recorded in the beginning of Masechet Ediyot. Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai had about, I believe, 316 arguments in the Talmud. I didn't learn them all and count them up. I cheated. You know, you look it up now in computer programs. They can do that a lot faster. But they had hundreds of arguments. We spoke about that. Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim. They're both the words of living God. But Hillel and Shammai themselves argued very, very little. Hillel Omer, Hevi mi Talmidav, a very famous expression, Hevi mi Talmidav shel Aaron, be a student of Aaron. So that's a very interesting thing. Ohev shalom verodev shalom, love peace and run after peace. So what does the expression Hevi mi Talmidav shel Aaron add? Why couldn't Hillel just say Ohev shalom or verodev shalom? Love peace. In other words, I don't know, I'm not sure I have a great answer to this question. If somebody does, you know, in other words, be like a student of Aaron. What does it mean to be a student of Aaron? To love peace and to run after peace. So on a simple level, that's what we explain. That Aaron was a seeker of peace. I'm sure many people know the famous Midrash, that he would go to two people who were fighting. He would tell a white lie. He really wants to make up with you. And he wants to make up with you. And they would meet. They would come and they would make up. So it's telling us, you know, the greatness of Aaron. Okay, we also know Aaron is a peacemaker. He was willing to let a golden calf be built. I mean, that's a big debate among the commentaries. Did he go too far? You know, how far can you go in bending over and being nice to people? And that's really a machloket in the Farshim. The Torah itself seems to hint that Aaron went too far when not in Kitisa. The Torah often does that. The Torah later on in Parshat Ekev, when it says that when Moshe recounts the story of the golden calf, so Moshe says he prayed to God for God to listen. And I forget the exact language, but God listened a little bit. God listened to the birth, but not totally. And Rashi says, you know, well, he killed Nadav and Avihu, but he let Elazar and Itamar live. It's like, wow. Wow. In other words, that the punishment for the Chedega was at Nadav and Avihu. That's not how we normally understand Nadav and Avihu. They got drunk or they did something against Moshe and Aaron. But here, Rashi alludes to the notion that this was a punishment for Aaron, for the sin of the golden calf, and he got half punishment. Nadav and Avihu, really a harsh Rashi. But anyways, that is a debate. How far do you go? But in general, Aaron is the king peacemaker. So maybe the mission wants to tell us that, to follow in that path. Even Aaron can do that. I think the Tosfot Yontif said the Mishnah wants to point out that even though Aaron was the younger brother, we all know that he was the older brother, that Moshe was the younger brother, that in Sefer Bereishit, every family fought. And every fight was about who gets the rights of being the firstborn, in a sense. They're always the younger and the older are fighting in every generation. And the older resents the younger. So here you have Aaron, even though he was older, understood the greatness of Moshe. They worked together so beautifully. There wasn't any jealousy. So that's perhaps to stress that point, that Aaron HaKohen was willing, even when you feel, you know, I'm more deserving, but you realize that maybe someone else is more deserving, someone else who's young. But whatever it is, we should be like Aaron. The Mishnah is pointing out the greatness of Aaron was Ohev Shalom. He loved peace and he ran after peace. And the Mefarshim say, we say it when we daven every Shabbos. No, Bakei Shalom Virad Frehu. I forget now the other half of the pasuk, but we all know Bakei Shalom V'Radfehu. You have to seek peace and run after it. And the Mishnah says this is the only mitzvah you have to run after. You don't have to run after mitzvot. If a mitzvah comes to you, you have to do it. And if there's a mitzvah, you should do it at the first opportunities. Rizim makdimim lemitzvot. You have a brit milah, do it early in the morning. But you don't have to. You don't have to go bird hunting so you can. That's the example they give. Ki yikare kansipor. If you happen to come across a bird nest, then you send away the mother's bird. But you're not supposed. I know, not supposed to. But there's no value in going hunting to find a bird. We would think the opposite. Why not? I can get a mitzvah. Remember, that's almost the only mitzvah we're promised a long life. And then the Medrash says no. No, you better, you know, just work, do what you have to do. Do your work, help the community. Don't worry about bird hunting. If you happen to be in the forest and you come across a bird nest, great. But ki kare, if it happens, the same thing, lost object. Rav Moshe Feinstein goes so far as to say, there's no mitzvah. I mean, it's a funny thing, but like, there's no mitzvah to become wealthy to give a lot of charity. If you're wealthy, you should give a lot of charity. I don't know that that's exactly true. I think there's some people, their role in life is to be very wealthy and to support, to give lots of tzedakah, but whatever. But the idea was, it's not, you don't have to do the, even tzedakah, you don't have to do tzedakah. And the Torah says, im kesef tal bet ami, if you lend money. So there are a lot of explanations why it says im, but the one simple one is, if you can afford it, im kesef tal bet, many people can't afford to give charity, can't afford to loan people, that's fine, nothing wrong with that. The only mitzvah you have to run after is peace. Ohev shalom v'rodev shalom, bakei shalom v'radfeyu. And because peace is so important, we can tell a white lie, like Aaron did. I want to point out, this Aaron Levine has in his articles, the great Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine, my dearly departed professor at Yeshiva University, really the person in many ways who, like same way how Lord Jacobowitz sort of invented the field of Jewish medical ethics, so Aaron Levine kind of invented the field of Jewish business ethics. It's not as popular as Jewish medical ethics, but it was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, enormous Talmud Chacham, and a PhD in economics, the head of the economics department at Yeshiva University. And he took a number of courses with him. He's written at least five books, more than five books, many, many articles on applying Torah economic principles to modern life. If you're interested in that field, it's amazing. Beautiful how he talks, everything. He talks about all the advertising, mean, anything you can think of, investing in the stock market, external cost, trade barriers, anything you talk about from a halakhic point of view. So when he talks about lying and jobs in the marketplace, and when you have to do things, you know, how far can you go, etc. So he points out two things, that of course we can lie, I mean, it's not, I mean, for peace. However, there are two exceptions to the rule. Anybody want to guess? I've been talking a lot. I don't know if I see if who's, anybody want to guess what or maybe you know what the two exceptions are. You can put it in the chat box when you're not allowed to lie, even for peace. Okay. Does that mean I have to go on? Okay. So the two exceptions seem to, number one is a beautiful idea, children. Adults understand nuance. Kids are brutally honest. We all know that. They're sometimes too honest for our liking. But we know how dangerous it is. But if you teach kids to lie, it's awful. It will ruin their character because their character is developing. So, like for example, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has a tshuva. Let's say a mashulach comes to the door, whatever. You get a phone call from some agency. You don't want to speak to them, so they say, "Hello, can I speak to Mr. or Mrs. Kelman?" So I know. So I say they're not home. Okay, that's a lie. That's a lie. They are home. But what I'm going to say, I don't want to speak to you. It's not so nice. So you say they're not home, call back. That's what I often do, occasionally do. But if there's a kid in the room, you cannot do such a thing, because the kid, when you're not home, the kid doesn't understand that I'm not obligated to speak to everybody who comes to my door. So it's very important. You cannot lie in front of kids. The Gemara has a funny story with, I believe it was Rav, and now I have to check. Him and his wife, you know, I guess they didn't have, not all the rabbis had the greatest marriages in the world. Maybe they had a great marriage, but maybe on this issue, not a great marriage. Anyways, the Gemara says when Rav would ask for, you know, pea soup, his wife would make, you know, carrot soup. And when he'd ask for carrot soup, his wife would make, you know, pea soup. And this went on all the time. So he never got the soup he liked. Okay. So a whole different world, right? The way he, one day he said to his son, you know, mommy's really nice. I asked for pea soup and I got pea soup. She's changed her way. So the kid said, no. Daddy, you don't understand. When you asked for pea soup, I told mommy you wanted carrot soup. So she would make you pea soup. So the father told the son, don't do that. Lindu b'neim, you know, Shekhar, don't teach your kids ever, even though he didn't tell his kid to lie, but his kid did that. So you never allow kids to lie because that will ruin their character. That's one important exception. The second exception is habituality. This is where Aaron Levine talks about it a lot. When you, I have to lie on a constant basis. If I'm in a work environment, you know, if I see my boss cheats, lies to a client, so I may not have to whistleblow. If you're an outsider, you have to whistleblow. But if I'm an insider, I might lose my job. So more than 20%, and it only happens, probably I don't have to whistleblow, because in to violate a sin passively, I don't have to risk my livelihood. But if it's every day, if I'm in an environment where the whole culture is cheating and cutting corners, then you cannot be in such a culture. I just point that out because I think it's an important idea. You can lie sometimes for peace, but you have to be careful. It's not like this blanket thing. And it's, I think it's a beautiful idea. You have to be very careful with younger people, and you have to be careful that you can do once in a while, but you can't do it every day. Okay, just very, very quickly. And then I just, oh, hey, veda priyotam akarvam latur. You have to love people. That's also apparently what Aaron did. You have to love people and bring them closer to Torah. And I remember I heard this directly, I believe, from Norman Lam. He should be well. Dr. Norman Lam, president of Yeshiva University. And he said these are two, I think he quoted Rav Chaim of Volozhin, and these are two independent ideas. It's not that we love people so that we can bring them to Torah. This is not a keyword mission. You know, I'm going to invite you to my house, you know, and be friendly with you, because if I do that, you'll come to love Torah. You have to ohev et habriyot, comma, umakarvam the Torah, and bring people closer to Torah. Now, of course, if you love people and you're an observant Jew, you're much more likely to bring them closer to Torah. As a matter of fact, the Mefarshim point out what Aaron did, besides, you know, telling the two people they want to make up, is he was very friendly to people who were sinners. And the Tosfos Yontif says he kind of disagrees with what we spoke about last week, Nita or Bailey, Harchek Mishachein Ra, run away from a neighbor. That's not be a direct contradiction. And Aaron HaKohen felt a little bit different. Says, if I want to have any influence on my neighbor, I have to be friendly with him, even if he's a sinner. That's the way you have to ohev et habriyot everybody. And that would often bring them mekarvam, literal. I'll end, I have to end a couple minutes early today because there's a tweak schedule at Shaft. This is actually my last day of teaching my grade 12 class. So I have to end a few minutes earlier. I apologize, but I will end with the idea what the Gemara says, you have to love God. And the Mishnah says, how do you love God? The Gemara reads it, you should make others love God, right? When you love something, when you get engaged, you want to, you know, bring your boyfriend, girlfriend, want to show everybody you love something, you want to share it with people. So if you love God, you want to share that love with other people. And the Gemara says, how do you make other people love God? So the example of the Gemara is if you're honest in business. If you're you speak nicely to people, nachat, kindly, masav emata b'emunah, and you conduct your business dealings, and people say, ah, this is wonderful. The person who learned Torah, he's such a nice person, he's such an honest person, I want to also be like that. But if, God forbid, it's the opposite, then a person's going to say, oh my God, he claims he's a religious person and this is what he does. I want to have nothing to do with such a person. And the strong implication, and I'll let you think about it for a while, because it's a Gemara in Yuma 86a. If you want to look it up and see it inside, Yuma 86a, you can look it up in English. The strong implication of the Gemara is that if you're going to be unethical and not be nice to people, it's better not to keep kosher or Shabbat, because the hypocrisy, so to speak, between the religiosity in one realm and not in the other, where it says, oi, because of him, he's religious, I don't want anything to do with religion because he's dishonest. If you're not religious, you're dishonest, they're not going to blame religion. That's the implication. That's a harsh implication. But that's what the Gemara seems to say. But to love Torah, to bring people closer, you have to love people. And the way to bring them closer to Torah is being honest and being nice with them. So just to very quickly wrap up, we spoke about Shmaiva of Talion being converts, perhaps, what their origins are. The grandchildren, Sancheriv, evil can often lead to great goodness if you use it properly, the idea of loving work independently. To love work, you'll do it better, but you have to love work even if you're very, very, very wealthy. Be very careful with power and what it can do to you and then corrupt you, and don't get close to power. A, they're not honest. B, if you want a patronage appointment that is incorrect. The leaders especially have to be very careful what they say. The oaths are said to the leaders, and you have to love peace, be like Aaron, love peace, seek peace. That's the only mitzvah. Other mitzvahs, if they happen to come across, you should, of course, do it. You should love all people, bring them closer to Torah independently. Briyot, yes, somebody asked you, do briyot imply bringing non-Jews to our mitzvah? It could be, maybe we can talk about that a little next week. Yeah, ohavet briyot, very good. Doesn't just mean Jews, briyot means all creation. It even means animal kingdom. Briyot is not, it's not Adam. Adam means all of humanity. Yisrael means Jew, Adam means all of humanity. Briyot means all of creation. Everything is creation. Somebody also pointed out the bride on her wedding day. Yes, that's a different type of lie. Absolutely. That's the classic case. Kates of Moroccan deep day. A color, you can lie, we can discuss why, but that's a subjective idea. That's what we want to, we want to make everybody feel joy. You don't want to tell the person, you know, you don't like the bride. Is all brides are beautiful. Please God, we should see brides get married, and we should have, be able to make weddings and bigger wedding or whatever. People can come have a minion at the wedding. Anyway, we should have simchas. Everybody be well. I want to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. Our next class, of course, is on Sunday morning, Rabbi Adam Mintz, 11 a.m. in the morning. And we look forward to seeing you all next week, all during the week. And please God, we'll continue next Friday. Okay, Shabbat Shalom, everybody.
Shabbat Shalom.
Be well.